Accession number 14253, Reel 2.
Here's Reel 2.
Zigzag, keeping station on a particular ship in the convoy. And that was our main job. Of course, we were also looking out for any U-boats, and that was the main danger. Before we got too far out, away from the land, we would occasionally get a Focke Wulf, or perhaps other German aircraft, Condor, and they'd come over and report our position, of course, back to the U-boats. But we had no defence against them at that time. We had no aircraft, and they kept out of range of the anti-aircraft guns, so we were powerless. Occasionally, so one of the ships would send them a rude signal, which they probably didn't understand, but that was about it.
Were there any problems keeping station?
Well, in bad visibility there were, yes. And of course, sometimes at night, one might find one had wandered a little bit off station, but generally speaking, no, it wasn't too difficult, really. There were plenty of eyes on the bridge trying to see where we were.
You had to take your turn on watch, did you?
Yes, we were we were in three watches, so it was basically four on, eight off, and of course broken up by the dog watches, etc.
When did you first run into the U-boats? Do you remember that?
Well, we seemed to. We at this particular time, we were running convoys to Gibraltar, down into that area, which meant, of course, that one had to take a pretty wide sweep into the Atlantic to keep out of range of the German aircraft that were based in France. And we on most of the convoys, we had U-boat attacks. There was one particular convoy I remember, which was quite a notorious one. That was HG. I made a note of that. HG 76, I think. We were coming home. That was homeward from Gibraltar, number 76. And we had a small aircraft carrier. It was a converted merchant ship called, I think it was called the Avenger. And this had one or two aircraft on it. But that was invaluable to us because it meant that the German aircraft could be attacked or at least deterred when they knew we had it from coming around and reporting us. But in this particular convoy we had a very heavy U-boat attack. I think it was just off northern Portugal, and we lost the Avenger. Small aircraft carrier was lost. A lot of the survivors went on to the I think it was a sloop, the Deptford, and that was sunk, I think, the following night, and we took in quite a lot of the survivors, and by then they were a little bit worried, you know, because they'd been sunk twice, and they thought, you know, it could be third time unlucky on the Convolvulus, but we were fortunate. We used to see, well, this again, slightly a lighter note. We on watch. We used to watch, of course, for a torpedo coming because you know, you could, if you saw it far enough away, you could take evasive action or hope to. And very often, in those waters, you'd see something coming straight for the ship, and it was a dolphin. and you'd see it turn away at the last minute. You know, your heart would stop and then start again. But, I think we were helped by having the shallow draft, of course. It was because some torpedoes were fired at us and missed, and they went underneath the bows.
Did you ever spot a U-boat?
Oh yes, we spotted, you know, quite a few. We used to go in and attack them, and occasionally they were sunk. Sometimes we weren't sure. Sometimes they got away. But yeah, that was a bad convoy, HT-76. We lost quite a lot of shipping on that one. One or two tankers went up, which didn't look very nice at all.
What did you feel personally about the lot of the Merchant Navy men as opposed to the Royal Navy people?
Well, I thought they were in much greater danger than we were. They were bigger targets, they weren't as well armed, they hadn't got the speed that we had in the main. No, we felt a great deal of sympathy for them. They were splendid people.
You didn't, there wasn't any jealousy because of the difference in money?
Oh, no, none whatever, no. No, money didn't really enter into it, I don't think at all.
What was the attitude towards the U-boat crews who were carrying out the attacks? Was there any hatred of the enemy?
I wouldn't say there was, you know, really. They, you know, they were doing their job as we were doing ours. I know one heard of U-boats, you know, machine gunning, open boats. Well, I never experienced anything like that at all. Whether those stories were true or not, possibly they were, but in a war you always get this sort of extreme behaviour on one side or the other. No, I would say there was no hatred at all towards them, really. I mean, it was... We felt they were very brave people, you know, in these U-boats. They had a hell of a life. I wouldn't have wanted to be in a U-boat. No way.
How do you think they would have been treated aboard if you'd have had any captives?
Oh, quite civilly, yes. Oh, I don't think there would have been any problem at all.
Was Convolvulus normally on the Gibraltar run whilst you were with her?
She was on the Gibraltar run for quite a while. Then we did some runs down into the Mediterranean, convoys going towards Malta, and then we later, now this would be when, this would be Operation Torch. It was the invasion of North Africa, wasn't it?
Yes.
I'm trying to think of a date for that.
It was November 42.
November 42, that's right, yes. We were involved in that. We picked up just by Gibraltar. We joined up with the Americans and everybody, and we had this enormous armada going down the Mediterranean. And our particular section headed for Oran in that area. And we were fortunate in that the response was not too violent at all there. You know, it was a fairly easy landing for them.
Did you not get attacked going into Iran?
No, we didn't. No, we didn't go actually into Iran. It was coastal near Iran. Well, there were attacks. I mean, there were U-boats around, there were planes, the German, Italian planes, but the invasion, of course, was generally successful and didn't pose too many problems. We feared worse things than actually happened. I think my abiding memory of that was being... We'd been in three watches. We then had to go into two watches because... There was so much going on, so much signalling and so many ships, etc. And I can remember, I've never been so tired in my life. I was watching a depth sounder, part of my duty then, because we were going in very close to the shore. And I remember sort of holding my eyes open. It was, I'd been awake so long, I couldn't remember when I'd last been asleep. And but anyway, you know, it was just sort of small thing one remembers about that occasion.
By a depth sounder, you mean ASDEC?
No, 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 it was a depth sound. Find the depth of the water, just checking the depth of the water. It was a sort of a... well, it was a sort of an ASDEC, yes, it was, I suppose. But it's the sort of thing they have on the ships to establish the depth of water underneath the ship as you're going in close, particularly.
Why did they have that arrangement of watches when it was making people so tired?
Well, because we were, you know, we're only a small ship, and we were surrounded by big ships, important ships, and they kept sending us messages, and one signalman couldn't cope. You see, you might be getting two messages at the same time, and it reminds me of a... I don't know whether you're interested in amusing anecdotes.
Yes, please.
But I can remember, I think it was on one of these, at this particular time, I was on duty as signalman, and the procedure was that if a naval ship, a senior naval officer, was calling us up, you see, from his ship, and if it was going to be a long involved message, they prefixed it by the word pad, which meant, right, get somebody to write this down because you won't remember it all yourself, you see. So I looked around the bridge to see who I could find. And there was a young seaman lookout from the Outer Hebrides. I can't remember his name. And I said, Jock, I said, will you come and write this down for me, this signal? And he says, oh, he says, I'm no so good. Oh, I said, doesn't matter about being so good. It doesn't matter about your writing, etc. So anyway, the message came, and I was reading it and calling it out, in Morse, of course, calling it out to him. And eventually I got the AR at the end, which was the signing off. I acknowledged, and I said to Jock, right, let's have a look what you've got. I thought, it won't be too good, but I'll make something of it. He hadn't got a damn thing. He says, oh, he says, I tried to tell you, he says, I cannot read or write. So I sackcloth and ashes, I then had to go back to this other ship and ask them to repeat the last message. And of course they were mad as hell, and the operator at the other end, he sent it as fast as he could, you know. He thought, I'll get this blighter, you know. But I always remember that. It's quite amusing, really.
Do you have any memories of those Malta convoys?
Well, we never actually went as far as Malta. We took them so far, and then another escort group used to take, coming out from Malta, would take them in. We went as far as places like Philippeville and Bougie. I remember Philippeville on one occasion. We went in there. It was a small port on the North African coast. And I think the majority of Cunningham's Force H were there. And at night, the Germans and Italians sent over, I think, every plane they possessed to attack. They knew Force H was there. They weren't interested in us particularly, but they knew Force H were there, and they sent everything in. I've never heard a noise like it in my life, you know. The bombs were coming down, every gun was firing. It was absolute hell, it really was. They didn't do much damage, actually, but it was very noisy while it lasted.
What was life like ashore in Gibraltar?
Oh, that was very civilized, really. We used to buy bananas and onions and take them back home for the family, you know, and they used to give them to their friends. It was very pleasant in Gibraltar, really. You'd go and have a swim in the Mediterranean there.
Did you ever take any convoys out towards America?
No. Only towards America, but never went across all the way.
Why was that?
Well, because the escort would come from the other side and they would exchange, they would take them on and we'd come back, probably with a return convoy from America. We used to occasionally do that, but not very often.
Was Convolvulus hit whilst you were in her?
No. We lost our first captain. The story was that he'd been to a dance in Liverpool and was rather worried about getting back to the ship, and he borrowed a bicycle, fell off and broke his arm. So we lost him. We acquired a new captain. He was a Lord Churston. He was RNVR. I suppose he'd been a yachtsman pre-war.
How did he perform as captain?
He was completely laid back. Nothing at all. I don't remember him registering any emotion of any sort. Completely deadpan. I don't know that we had as much confidence in him because we were never quite sure whether he knew what was happening, you know. But
he old or young?
Well, he must have been, I suppose. He was a great big, tall, bearded man, very heavily built. I think he looked a lot older than he really was. He was probably late 30s, I would think, at the time. But we survived with him. He used to come up on deck, you know, if there was an alert of some sort, and he could never find his tin hat. He used to say, "Who's got my tin hat?" Well, nobody had his tin hat. He just lost it. And then he couldn't find his binoculars. "Who's got my binoculars?" And I think that was all he ever said, really. Strange. Of course, the captain was also the medical officer. There was no medical officer on board, on the Convolvulus. The captain had a little book, you know, first aid for whatever. And if you weren't feeling too well, you went and saw the captain. He diagnosed your problem and gave you something, you know, number 9 or number 10 or whatever. And that was it, you know, unless you were desperately ill, and in which case you'd be transferred to another ship.
Did people fall sick on board?
Oh, no, not if they could help it, no. Well, I mean, we did lose one or two people, just could never get used to the motion, and they just had to leave. They were ill all the time, you know, and so they were transferred to larger ships.
Once you were in Convolvulus, did you think that Britain was winning the War of the Atlantic or not?
Well, it was very difficult to form any opinion at all because, you know, we never had a news bulletin, we had no newspapers, we didn't know what was happening in the wider world at all. All we knew what was happening was what was happening in our own little area, you know. And it was very difficult to judge that because we, you know, we were taking very heavy losses. And I don't think any of us really appreciated what was happening in the wider context of the war. Not in any detail at all.
But you were in Convolvulus, apparently, from October 41 to July 43.
Yes.
Did you feel during that period that you were getting on top of the U-boats? Was there any sense of progress?
I think we felt we were holding our own, certainly. And yes, there was progress in that we were getting escort, small escort carriers. We were getting more aircraft cover, long-range aircraft cover from Britain, which was a great asset to us, of course, you know, Coastal Command and all this. And they were, these aircraft, the Sunderlands and so on, they were picking up the aircraft, they were attacking them if they found them on the surface, and very efficiently. And yes, I think we got the sense that things were swinging against the Germans at that time.
Were you as happy aboard Convolvulus as you had been aboard Adventure?
Oh yes, yes. It was a very nice ship to be on, really. It was small, you know, it was a friendly, companionable sort of ship, and certainly in the communication mess deck we had some very, very congenial people. You know, most of us, there were the two leading hands. There was a leading signalman, Briggs. Now, Briggs, I understand, had been one of the three survivors from the Hood.
I've interviewed him.
Have you? Briggs.
Ted Briggs.
Yeah. Well, he was our leading signalman. A fine chap. How is he?
Well, this was years ago.
Yeah, I believe he's still alive. Yeah. Yes, well, Briggs. He had been with the Hood, hadn't he?
Yes.
That's right. He
three
was one
survived.
Of three. Yes. Now, an awfully nice man. Very charming chap, you know.
He is.
Very, very nice. And there was a leading telegraphist called Convery. I don't know what happened to him. I never saw him after I left the ship. And I think there was one signalman, and they had been the only regular naval staff amongst the communications people. But, you know, we had, amongst our signalmen, we had somebody who'd been a school teacher, and somebody a stockbroker, and other civil servants, teachers, architects, you know. A nice cross-section of people, and we had a great... We used to enjoy life together, you know, go ashore and have a drink and all this sort of thing.
I don't know if you've read a book called The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Monserrat.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
About Atlantic
I've got
convoy.
It somewhere, yes.
Does he paint a true picture of what it was like?
Oh, yes, I think he does, yes. Very true to life, really. Oh, yes. There's one... little aspect of life on that ship that quite surprised me and surprises other people too, I think, and that was the cooking arrangements. They on the upper deck, they had a galley, and this was coal-fired. Can you believe it? Coal-fired galley, and you can imagine the heat in that place, especially in the hot climate down the Med or somewhere. And there was the one chef, we called him Chef, he liked to be called Chef, and there was the officer's steward who prepared the food for the officers and took it up to the galley. The chef would see that it was cooked properly. And each of the messes, there were two seamen's messes, the communications mess and the stoker's mess. One of the petty officers' mess, that's right. They used to prepare the food themselves, such as it was, and take it up to the galley, and the chef would just see that it was cooked. In other words, he took it off if it was burning, sort of thing, you know. And the chef, I have a mental image of him now. He was a fairly tall man with a bald head, the heat and the long nose. And the heat was absolutely intense in there, and you'd see him staring, and the perspiration would be pouring off his head, down his nose, into the pots. It gave it that added flavour. Oh dear, it was. And he was also the ship's barber. So if somebody wanted a haircut and it got really drastic, they'd go up to the galley and they'd sit on a chair there, and the chef would be cutting their hair with one hand and stirring the pots with another.
Any other incidents that stick out in your mind from Convolvulus?
Well, let's have a look. Right. As I mentioned, we ate corned beef until we couldn't stand the sight of it any longer. And we were alongside an American naval ship, I think it was in Gibraltar, and we got talking to the people on board, and they said, they said, we've got these soya links. Do you like them, you see? And we tried them. We thought they weren't too bad. They were sausages made of soya flour. So we did an exchange with them. We gave them corned beef for soya links. That was a bad deal. But after a couple of days, we couldn't stand these soya links. We said, bring back the corned beef, all is forgiven. You know, it was quite something. I remember we used to go into Londonderry quite frequently, and when we were going through, I think it was Loch Ney, on the way into the Londonderry River.
Loch Foyle?
Loch Foyle, was it? Yeah, Loch Foyle, you're right, you're Loch Foyle. And there was a very nice house with the banks running down to the water, and there was a lady used to, as soon as she saw us coming through, she used to run out with a British flag, waving it, elderly lady, waving it madly, running down to the water's edge, you see. And we thought, oh, the dickens is that, you know. Anyway, it turned out it was old Montgomery's mother. Yes, so we were told.
Now, I think in 43-44, somehow you got involved with the Fleet Air Arms.
Well, yes. I had applied to to join. I thought I'd like to see if I could get into the Fleet Air Arms as a pilot. So I applied, and I was accepted. Took time, of course. And then I had to get back to the UK from Mediterranean. And on the way, I picked up a lovely dose of dysentery, which meant going into hospital in Gibraltar for a few weeks. Anyway, I got back on a destroyer and started my training at where was it? The HMS St. Vincent at Gosport, that's right. And did the course, which I managed to pass all right. And then went over to Canada for the actual flying training. Well, the weather, we got there in the middle of the Canadian winter, went out to a place called Goderich, which was on the shores of one of the great lakes, Huron, I think. And we never saw the ground. Of course, it was covered with snow and ice. Conditions were very bad, and in the end the weather was so bad that only a few of the course got enough hours in to get through, and I came back. I didn't get enough hours in. I couldn't complete the course, so that was the end of it. They had another course coming up behind, so they